Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for the needlework artist. And back after almost a year absence, Allison Cole. Hi, Allison.
Hey, Gary. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming back here. Now, it was November of 2018 that we first talked.
Just doesn't seem that long ago.
Nope. And we got Allison here today because she has a new book out, and I've been monitoring the progress of that book, and I said to myself early on, when that thing is ready to go, we got to do a show because I got to learn about it. So we're going to learn about gold work and then your new book, Gold Work Masterclass. And I've seen you sent me several pages here, and I was ready for, you know, with a title like that, I was ready for a book that I couldn't even relate to. But this is perfect. Anybody can get in this.
Yeah, definitely. It's aimed for beginners upwards. So it's a book for everyone. So it's based on the Goldwork Masterclass that I'm teaching at the Embroiderers Guild. They've actually just finished their classes, and they set up their exhibition on the 1st of September and have their opening night party on the 6th of September. So it's just around the corner for them. They're frantically trying to finish their final pieces. But I've incorporated not only that, but all what I put in my beginners classes and in my intermediate certificate classes as well. So it is a book for everybody. So it's written so that everybody can understand it.
Yeah, well, that table of contents, that's about as comprehensive as you're going to get when it comes to really any stitching technique. Boy, that's just a couple, three pages of topics. And that's because I just sat there. Holy smokes, the whole waterfront is covered with this one. This is really great.
Yeah, well, being a masterclass, you've got to try and touch on as much as you possibly can. And it would be nicer to go into more detail in some of these subjects, but that's for a future book. So at the moment, you know, you can't fit everything into one book. The book weighs nearly a kilogram now. So the shipping is horrendous on it, and we've tried to keep the price as low as we can so that people can afford it, because it really is. It's like a university textbook. You know, it has everything in it. Yeah. So.
And the timing is great because we're recording this. Let's see, this goes up Sunday, and we're recording on Wednesday, and the books are arriving today. So,
yep.
How fresh is that?
Yep, hot off the press.
Yeah. Well, we were going to talk about gold work stuff first, but let's just talk about the book. So, what gets you going? What makes you want to do this book? Because this is so comprehensive. You got to make a decision early on about what kind of book you're going to do when you go into this depth.
Well, the whole reason for doing this book is the same reason I did the Stumpwork Masterclass, is that producing this course for only 15 ladies is a hell of a lot of work for only 15 people. And while the course will run again, I anticipate it'll run over and over the next, you know, however many years. I mean, it's a 2-year course to start with. So, and then I've done, you know, my lifetime's research that I've been doing before that, but then I did some more intensive research leading up to it, and I had probably 2 years of prep work leading up to it. So, you know, when you're putting that much work into something, you think, well, I'm going to publish it, because then it can get out to a wider audience. It needs to go to more than 15 people. And it was the same with the Stumpwork Masterclass. It was a massive amount of work. 7 years of my life went into that one, and numerous overseas trips and research and study. And so this is the same. You know, it just seems a shame to not get it out there for everybody who enjoys goldwork embroidery or who'd like to take it up.
Yeah. So if someone taking your classes, then this should be right at their side.
Yeah, well, next time we run the Goldwork Masterclass at the Guild, we'll be able to say, here's the book, you know. Whereas, you know, the girls have been getting lesson notes, you know, lesson after lesson, they receive a new set of notes, which have been delivered electronically, so they can print them out and study them at home, work out in advance what they need to bring to class. So that's been really cool, a different way of approaching it to previous masterclasses. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the ones in the future, they'll actually have a textbook that they can just pick it all up and have it to go. So it'll be really good.
Just like going to university, by golly.
That's it. Well, a lot of the ladies say, you know, that doing the masterclasses that we run here with the Embroiderers Guild of Victoria, the amount of work and the amount of research that they do and the amount of stitching they have to do, it's like doing a master's, and they're putting together essays and you know, it's basically a thesis, and at the end they get a piece of paper that means nothing because no university will recognise it.
Right.
But, you know, it's probably in America where you do have textiles at university level. Here in Australia, it's just very uncommon. You know, there's nothing like this at university level. So we've got universities that have courses in, you know, setting up your studio and you know, different things, but not intensively looking at a subject like this. So
yeah,
it's a hell of a lot of work for a piece of paper.
Now, one of the things I noticed in the pages that you sent me was that you actually have a at least in my mind, a notable collection of gold work, old original gold work pieces.
I do, yes.
Yeah,
so there's five images in there that have been provided by the National Gallery of Victoria, which are credited as such. And there's four images, I think it's four, from the Embroiderers Guild's collection, but all of the other antique pieces in that are from my own collection. So I have a piece, I don't have a piece of Opus Anglicanum, unfortunately, but I do have a piece of original Ornouet, which is close to 600 years old. So that's probably my oldest piece of gold work in my collection. Probably my most impressive piece of gold work in my collection is the Matador's suit of lights, which is beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, I have to say that picture stopped me. Like, wow, you own that thing? Oh, my.
Yeah. I'm very lucky.
Yeah. Where did you find that?
Online in America. It was in an auction in America, and I put in a bid and went to bed, and I actually went to bed in a very bad mood. a friend of mine had just passed away, and I said to Steve, I want to up my bid. And he says, no, we talked about this, and we talked about how much it's going to cost and how much, you know, the buyer's premium that gets added on and then the shipping that gets added on.
Right.
And, you know, we start with how much we're prepared to pay and then have to take those things into account and work backwards. And so I was really I was grumpy with Steve because I wanted to put in a higher bid. And so the next morning I got out of bed and I opened up the laptop and I thought, oh, well, let's see how much it went for. And, you know, and I went, oh, hang on, that's under my bid. I was like, oh, I got it.
Oh, my.
I actually got it for less than what I'd initially put my bid in for. So, yeah, there was just nobody bidding against. Well, there were people bidding, but they'd stopped. So,
yeah.
I had a couple of $100 grace there. So the really sad part was it arrived while I was teaching in Canada. I passed it on the way over. So Steve sends me photos. Actually, he Skyped me. We never Skype, but he Skyped me that day. He said, look what I've got.
Wow.
Oh, you bugger. So, yeah, he unpacked it, made sure it was all intact and everything was good because I was gone for a month. So
there's a dilemma where you want to leave it in the box so that you can open it, but, I'm sure he's debating in his mind, I really need to open this to make sure it's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And sometimes I order things while I'm away. There was when I was away teaching in America last time, I'd ordered a Bavarian bonnet. And I found that online at an auction while I was away. And I put in a bid and I got it. I was like, yay. And so I said to Steve, you'll be getting a box from America. Don't worry about opening it. Just put it in the bedroom.
Don't ask questions.
That was it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the golden hoop. So, and like I say, I had been bidding on those at many auctions overseas, and I'd never been successful in getting one. So I was really thrilled to have gotten that one. So
yeah, and this suit of lights looks to be in terrific shape.
It is, and it's fabulous because it really tells a story. Because you can see where it's been let out. Bullfighters are tiny little men, you know. Mm-hmm. They're like, I don't know, I'm sure that my son at 15 was bigger than what these, and my son's a skinny, weedy kid, but he would not have fitted into the pants of this bullfighter's costume.
Oh, you have the pants too? You have the jacket and the pants?
The jacket, the pants and the vest. Holy smokes. I have. we're actually going over to Spain on holiday. I'm going to be searching to see if I can get a pair of the beautiful pink socks and a matador's hat to go with it, because then I've got everything. Oh. Not that they have gold work on them, but it would be really nice to have the whole lot. So,
oh sure.
There's actually a guy on eBay at the moment who's cutting up matador costumes and selling them as vestment fragments. And they're not vestment fragments, they're matador fragments. And one of my students knows that and from doing classes with me, and she bought one, and he put that it was a fragment of a vestment. And I said, it's the top half of the leg of a suit of lights. So I think he's not putting what it actually is, in case people don't want to buy them, because there is a stigma attached to bullfighting. A lot of people, it does polarize people.
Bullfighting does, yes. Oh, very much.
It does, yeah. I put a beautiful photo of a matador in action on Facebook one day, and I had so many horrible, horrible trolley messages that I had to take it down. And it's like it was a comment on the embroidery. It wasn't a comment on bullfighting. Mm-hmm. And it was really sad that people couldn't look at that picture for what it was. It was spectacular embroidery. I guess that's why this guy on eBay is saying that they're vestments and theatrical costumes, because, you know, he'd know damn well what he's cutting up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's
a cultural problem. You know, that's a difficult thing to deal with, is just that kind of a thing. Because in the right culture, you know, those guys are heroes, looked up to, idolized, all kinds of things. It just comes from the culture, yeah.
And I think the other thing that people forget is that it actually has its roots in pagan religion, and a lot of the capes are all embroidered with pictures of the Madonna and Child. It's all a religious thing as much as a sport. So, you know, and it's not a good sport, but, you know, not all religion. Yeah, religion's not always been historically a good thing either. So,
right. Yeah.
Anyway, we won't get there.
Yeah, we could go down that path and talk for an hour about it and never solve a thing. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of history, and then three of the segments you have in there is some ceremonial, and then you look at Elizabethan and Stuart gold work, and then English embroidery from 1250 to 1400. Wow.
Yeah, so Opus Anglicanum is amazing, and there was a stunning exhibition of it over at the V&A a few years back, and Steve thought I was crazy, but I actually flew over just for the exhibition. So I flew over to England, spent 4 days in England, 3 days. I had bought four days worth of tickets to go to the exhibition, and while I was over there, Philippa Turnbull let me know that there was one on up at Durham at the time. So it was like, oh, okay. So I just didn't worry about the fourth day, and I grabbed a train ticket, and I took off up to Durham to see, because theirs was an Opus Anglicanum exhibition as well.
She's a dangerous enabler.
A much smaller one. She is, but yeah. it was really nice. She picked me up at the station. We went out for lunch and had a look at what they had up there, and it was a really nice compliment to what was at the V&A. I think the only sad part was the main piece of English work that everybody wants to see wasn't on display, and that was the maniple and stole of St Cuthbert. So, and then they were putting that on display in their new gallery at Durham Cathedral, but it wasn't going to be there until after I'd left. Oh. So even though I went back to England the following year, it was going. I was there like 2 weeks too early.
Oh, geez.
So it was like, oh my God, am I ever going to see this embroidery that I've studied for so many years? But anyway,
when you get stuff that old, that's actual gold, every bit of it, right?
It's usually gold that's aurum batarum, which is gold that has been beaten flat and then wrapped around either a thread or around animal membrane, and then it's couched onto the surface. But it's interesting because it's hard to study some of these things from Australia, because there's no Opus Anglicanum in Australia. So that was why I wanted to go over there. And when I'd been taught about it previously from, you know, say these ladies who mentored me, I always sort of thought, wow, how coarse does the linen have to be to get the gold to go down into it? And when you actually see it, you think it's nothing to do with how coarse the linen is. It's how fine the thread is. It's the exact opposite.
Oh.
And that the thread is as fine as a hair. So when you think about that, they are beating this gold and wrapping it around a thread and it's still as fine as a hair. That's incredible.
Wow.
It's so fine and so beautiful. Probably the closest thread we have to it today is tambour thread. That it is, you know, a 2% gold thread that is has a round profile you know, is really fine, but it's still not as fine as what was in some of the really old pieces. It's just gobsmacking. So
it was fantastic
to sit there and study.
Yeah, that amazes me, the craftsmanship that goes into the materials that result in beautiful craftsmanship.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And when you think that, you know, you're not even in an era of steam, you know, you're back in water-powered mills and horsepower. So it's just incredible to think that some of these things that they made and the things that they embroidered were just to die for. And like I say, it was brilliant. And the funny part was the V&A hadn't thought that people would want to spend a huge amount of time there. You couldn't get a pass out. You could only get a pass out to go to the toilet. You couldn't get a pass out to go get lunch. And so I'm like, I've got a banana in my handbag so that I can get a pass out, go to the toilet, eat a banana and come back. Because I was spending the whole day there sketching and taking notes and you know, and just you know, trying to get as much information as I could. I already had the book. One of my students had been at the opening of the exhibition. So I said to her, you're dead to me if you don't bring me back a book. so I had read that from cover to cover and studied it and filled it with post-it notes so that I knew exactly what pieces I wanted to look at closer and what I needed to see. You know, I wasn't going to be wasting any time while I was over there. So. And so I was studying there of a daytime and then I was stitching samples of an evening. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah. That's, you know, once in a lifetime kind of thing. You may never get another chance. Got to make the most of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the previous Opus Anglicanum exhibition was 50 years ago that they had all these pieces together. And that's what I said to my husband, the next time they get all these pieces together, I could be dead. So I had to go
once. Yeah. You got one shot. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the interesting thing about this book is so many books are project books, but this is not a project book. There's
one
sampler in this thing, right?
Yeah, there's a sampler for every chapter,
okay.
But there's only two samplers that I've put a pattern sheet in for you to do because a lot of them, like the couching sampler, there's actually two couching samplers, and one of them is just leaves. So at the end of the day, everybody can draw a leaf, you know, or everybody can find a picture of a leaf to use. There's no point putting down the exact drawings that I did. Whereas where I have turned the sampler into a design, then I've given you the design so that you can have a go at doing it. So there's an outline there for one of the Opus Anglicanum pieces. There's where I've put about in the section on gold work being combined with other techniques. There's the outlines there for a black work project, so black work and gold work and a stump work gold work and actually two black work gold works and a silk and gold based on English leek work. So so there's a few little projects in there, but it's not a project book. It doesn't give you a recipe. All my other books that have projects in them, they have a recipe of you need to buy this and this and this and this. For these, it just tells you what threads I've used so that you can work out your own quantities and things because it's not actually meant to be a project book, but I've just slipped those designs in because I had space for them. So it's like, right, I'm going to put them in. I'd already decided if there wasn't space, they wouldn't go in. If there was space, they would go in. So yeah. So there ended up being a couple of extra smaller ones in that combining techniques section because there was space there, so we'll pop them in. So,
tell me about one of the techniques that just intrigues me to no end is Or Nuée.
Yep.
Tell me about it. It looks difficult, is it?
No, it's dead boring. It's fabulous.
Okay.
It's something you can do while you're traveling and you can do it while you're watching TV. It's It's absolutely mindless and it's fabulous. It's so easy. It's thread painting goldwork style. So you put your design down onto your fabric, which is just a calico, just a cotton. Colour it in with the colours that you're going to use. Don't use watercolour paints. You don't want those colours to blend. You want them to stay as distinct, separate colours. And then you start couching your gold over the top and you're couching in the colours that your drawing is telling you underneath. And wherever you've got an outline, you need to make sure you've got a stitch. Otherwise, you don't end up with an outline. You'll have, you know, a petal that just sort of disappears into the ether. So you have to make sure that anything that's an outline has a stitch on it. Traditionally, it was done horizontally, couched in pairs using a fine thread, about equivalent to a passing thread number 3 today. And they would couch them horizontally in pairs. That results in only one plane of light. So you only get, it's either in the light or it's not. The whole thing's reflecting or it's dull. And it would have looked spectacular with flickering candles in churches in the 1400s when this was done.
That's the origin of it. That's where that really shines.
The origin.
Okay.
Yeah. And then in the 60s, they started couching in a circle because that then gives you two light planes. It gives you two opposing triangles moving around the circle. So it brings a bit more life to the embroidery. You get people who are couching horizontally. You get people who are couching vertically. And again, couching vertically is the same. You still only got that one light plane. And then you get where they started putting circles and things in. And it gives it does give more life to it. So I trained in how it was done traditionally and how it was done in the 60s. And I go, well, if the, you know, so-called modern way of doing it isn't a circle because it gives you two light planes, if I put an angle in here, so like a stylized dove shape, like, you know, the head and neck of a bird, if I add that into it, a wave, I'll end up with 5 to 7 light planes. So my pieces I call contemporary Ornaway because they're not actually really they're not traditional on the way. I do traditional. I have all three on my website and in my projects, and in the book, because it is really cool when you add the extra light planes because you do get a lot more movement and a lot more excitement out of the embroidery.
Is that one of the things that makes designing these things fun or a good challenge? Is that you can do so much more with light reflection than you can with, say, silk or cotton thread?
Yeah, you can do a lot with light reflection with silk as well, though. And cotton, when cotton's stitched, you know, in beautiful satin stitch and you don't overwork the thread, you can get good light reflection off of that as well. So putting stitches on different angles, even in satin stitch and cotton, you'll get good light reflection. But with the Ornouet, reflecting off of the gold, yeah, it's just a whole different ballpark. So the stitching itself is pretty mindless. And when I do it in a class, I say it's just a one-day class and we talk about the history and then everybody has an option of how they want to work their piece, whether they want to do it traditional or a la 1960s or modern or contemporary. And usually if in a 5-hour class, if they can get I say a 5-cent piece here, but for your American listeners, I'd say a dime. If you can get a dime covered in a day in a class, you're doing really well, which doesn't sound like much. Until you do it. But once you know what you're doing, because, you know, at that stage you're learning, once you know what you're doing, a piece that's, say, 5 by 7 centimetres, which is what, 2 by 3 inches, I can have that knocked over in 2 days. So, I'll do that in a weekend. Mm-hmm. Whereas a beginner person might spend months on that. So, and I remember when I first started doing Ornouet, the mentor who was from my first class, it was the same teacher, and I rock up and I've got this piece and it was quite large and a bit bigger than a postcard. And she says, no, you're meant to be doing something the size of a matchbox. Take that downstairs and shrink it down on the photocopier. So I shrunk it down 5%. So it was, It was still, it's still about 4 by 6 inches. And she says, you'll never finish that. And that was like red rag to a bull. So I not only finished it, I finished three others to go with it. So
there, take that.
So it was kind of funny. It's, I'm a bit of a masochist when it comes to things like that. If somebody says I can't do something, I go, why not? So, I learnt bobbin lace so that I could do it in metal, so that I could trim a gauntlet glove.
Oh.
And the teacher told me, you can't do this in metal lace. I said, of course you can. It was done in the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s. Why can't I do it? She said, no, it won't work with that thread. So I went back the next week with 2 feet of gold lace that was using the thread she told me I couldn't use. She just looked at me and walked away.
There's no response to that. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I still haven't done that gauntlet glove, but it is actually, I have started it now, and that was over a decade ago. We were working it out the other day. It's about 14 years ago that I did that, so I'm going to have to see if I can remember how to do lace now that I've finally started the glove.
Yeah, yeah. Take me through, you have chapters on padding, couching thread, ornoué, which we talked about, purl and fillings. What do those chapters give to me as a reader?
They give you techniques and materials. So when you're looking in the padding one, it's telling you all the different things that you can use for padding, you know, like padding with felt, whether you're then layering the felt or using a single layer, whether you're stuffing the felt, whether you're using thick felt like carpet felt. So, you know, it's giving you all the different options and it's showing you what the material looks like and telling you how to use it. And it's the same when you go into the section on other couching threads, it's the same kind of thing. It's identifying each thread because I think some of the problem is, and I found this when I did my very, very first book in 2006, people don't actually understand what they're ordering. So like with smooth purl, it comes in roughly meter lengths. I've had people accuse me of cutting it up. Why did you cut it off the reel and cut it up? And it's like it doesn't come on a reel and it's manufactured in meter lengths. So I put in that book a double page spread showing a whole heap of the different threads, how they come so that you can see that this comes on a reel and this doesn't. Mm-hmm. So this is similar. I've done a similar thing in that each thread, I've actually put a photo there because not a lot of people know what check thread looks like as opposed to check purl because they're two different things and have a similar name. The same with passing thread and Grecian and Rococo. They hear these, but they don't actually know what they're getting. And it's really hard for people, I mean, even some of the girls who have spent 2 years doing the masterclass with me are still have a bit of trouble identifying some of the threads that they don't use very, very often.
Yeah.
So it's a way of identifying the thread and finding out how it's used. And some of them are used, like everything that's a couching thread is couched on the surface. I get people who say you can't couch with this couching thread. If it says couching thread, it means you're taking a Gutermann thread and couching it down or a silk thread and couching it down. You're not actually doing the process of couching. And some of these are nearly as thick as my little finger. So, and some of them like to have a stitch that is at right angles to it. Some like to have a stitch that's on an angle. Some you stitch through the center of. You come up and split through the middle of the twist and then go down, which is also the way I apply a twisted cord because your stitches end up invisible and it's a more secure method of application. So it's looking at each individual thing and what it looks like and how to use it.
Okay, so then this book, even if I'm not using a particular type of thread, when I come to it at some point in the future, this will help me get oriented and know what to do and what not to do. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then for the Elizabethan and Stuart section, it's all really worked in passing threads. So what it is step-by-step photographs of how to do these beautiful stitches that seem so complicated. And once you've got them, you think, how did I not get this? You know, they're very interesting. And I love the way they interlace and they say plaited braid stitch is a stitch that really does a lot of people's heads in. But I think for me, a lot of people are trying to do it with things like yarn, you know, or stranded cotton or pearl cotton. And the problem is that as you're doing the weaving part, your needle will just spear straight through the thread. Mm. Whereas when you're using the metal threads, you can't spear through the thread. You know, it will slide through that weaving. You know, it will go under the loops. It won't just shortcut straight through the thread, because it hits the thread, it's like a little brick wall. It can't go anywhere.
Yeah.
So when people want to practice it with a cheaper thread, I actually tell them, no, don't. It's worth practicing with your good metal thread, because it's actually easier. You'll get it quicker and easier by using the right thread. Yeah. So that section's all step-by-step photographs, because I think most of the books that are out there are mainly, like, you know, with a drawn needle and, you know, one or two steps. They're not actually breaking it right down into do this and then it will look like that, and then do this and it will look like this. So I think the best book on the market by far is Jackie Carey's book, Elizabethan Stitches. I find that most students can get plaited braid much easier from that. A lot of the things that are out there tell you to, they've got you working a different direction. So when they've got you working towards yourself, and plaited braid stitch is much easier when you're working away from yourself. So I've tried to break it down even further than what Jackie's done. So, like I say, I think Jackie's book is a fabulous book for Elizabethan stitches, and I haven't got all the stitches that she's got. She's got way more stitches in her book. I've just looked at the common ones that are in a lot of pieces of work that people, you know, if you're wanting to have a go at making a reproduction coif or a jacket or something, then these are probably the main stitches that you would use. So,
yeah.
As far as gold stitches, so as I say, Jackie's book's got all the silk stitches and things in it as well. This is just looking at it from a gold work point of view.
Mm-hmm. Now, that speaking of other types, then you have a whole section where you're combining with more traditional embroidery techniques. You have silk shading, stump work, needle lace, black work, canvas work. In the old world tradition, was that done, or is that more of a modern day thing to combine?
Okay, so when you're looking at pieces of stump work, gold work was always in it. Mm-hmm. There was always elements of gold work in stump work, but there wasn't always detached stump work elements in gold work. So it was kind of a one-way relationship. They share a lot of the same paddings. I've always looked at, if you're going to do stump work and put gold in it, why not do some gold work and put stump work in it? So, you know, it is a two-way street. But historically, stump work has gold work in it, and it used it to great effect, you know. And some pieces, there's a piece at Fenton House, it's just about all metal thread. You know, there's a lot of silk in it, but there's a huge, you know, a lot more metal than there is in other pieces. And there's a couple of pieces at the Burrell Collection that are like that as well. Silk shading has always, in later years, probably in the last 200 years, silk shading has been, silk was used a lot in Opus Anglicanum, and it was used as split stitch. So silk has always been used with gold work, you know, going right back. But as far as doing silk shading goes, that's probably more only, you know, a few hundred years old. Probably the most famous, as I said before, is leek work, which was Thomas and Elizabeth Wardles set up the Leek Embroidery School and the Leek Embroidery Society, and it was a way of creating church furnishings and employing local ladies, and he was actually a silk importer, so it was kind of a vested interest. So he was importing the silk and dyeing it, and this is at the same time as William Morris. He actually was teaching William Morris how he dyed his silks. So that was when William Morris started dyeing things. So it's kind of very cool that a lot of these things all, if you're into embroidery history, a lot of these things are interlinked. So needle lace is something that you can incorporate into your gold work, you know, as like say in stump work, you've got needle lace that had metal thread coordinate edges and things like that. So again, something that's always been used, but you don't usually take your metal threads and work needle lace with them, and some of them you actually can, so as long as you're not doing something really, really fine, because it will drive you insane. As far as the black work goes, you know, traditional black work was just black thread, but when you look at pieces at at the Bath Fashion Museum, for example, a lot of the blackwork coifs were blackwork and goldwork. They had a lot of gold in them. If it was a shift, if it was, you know, like a bodice or a blouse, say, then that would be an undergarment, so it didn't have any metal on it. But if it was an outer garment that had blackwork on it, then it frequently had gold as well. Interestingly, though, the only person I know who's doing really, like, amazing gold work that has blackwork as a side instead of it being the other way around is Tanya Berlin, and she's got her Lion and Phoenix are amazing, that you've got standalone pieces of metal thread embroidery that have blackwork incorporating to create the design. Mm-hmm. So instead of gold work being a highlight, the blackwork. So,
yeah, she has a unique view. I really like her stuff. Yeah,
she's really cool. Yeah. So, and canvas work, I get asked a lot to design and do things on canvas. And realistically, when it comes to metal thread, it shouldn't be done on canvas. You can't lay pearl on canvas unless you put down a padding or something first. I get people who come to me who buy American magazines where somebody has gone and got some Congress cloth or canvas of some description, and they're laying pearl on it, and they say, this doesn't work. And I go, no, it doesn't, because it's not gold work is not a counted thread technique. You can put down a base of canvas work stitches. You can put all your Jessicas and everything you like down. You can get all of that down onto your canvas first and then put your gold work over the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if you really want to do laid work on canvas, you really need to put some felt or something down first so that you are working on a solid ground, because gold work should be worked, well, is worked better best on a solid ground fabric, so something with a close weave. So your silk dupion, you know, a cotton, a velvet, doesn't matter, but a close weave. And mm-hmm. by definition, canvas and Congress cloth is not a close weave. It has holes in it that people are trying to count. They say it's not a counted technique. So yeah, you can incorporate it, and there are things that you can use, because, I mean, when you look at the Elizabethan era, the sweet bags, they've all got gobelin stitch counted in the background. You know, it's metal thread work as a counted. So, you know, if you want to incorporate metal thread as a counted stitch, then do the counted stitches that were done in those period pieces, because they work beautifully on linen and things.
Mm-hmm.
But probably the biggest hint I can give you is if you are working on linen and you're stitching with a passing thread, so by definition, we said couching threads are couched on the surface, passing threads pass through the fabric. So you can pop it in a large-eyed number one crewel or a milliner's or a chenille, and you can stitch with it. But if you draw your thread at an angle, if you think about the way you normally stitch, most people, as they come through the fabric, pull their arm, you know, if they're right-handed, pull their arm sort of on a 45-degree angle to the right.
Mm-hmm.
If you do that with passing thread, it will shear straight through your background fabric.
Oh.
So
that's not good.
If you've got a nice piece of 32 count linen and you've just cut through four threads of it, you won't be really pleased. So when you're using a passing thread, the biggest hint in the world, needle straight up and needle straight down. You know, you have to complete the stitch in two movements. You can't just go up, down and pull. Won't work. You have to pull it all the way up and you pull it all the way down, and you're keeping your thread square, you know, at right angles to the fabric, because if you don't pull it straight up to the sky or straight down to the floor, it will shear straight through your fabric. So, like, and I have done it.
Like stitching with a little razor, huh?
It is. Well, it is. It's a gold-plated thread that is wrapped around a core thread. It is a passing thread because it's durable. It can go through the fabric.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not sharp on your hands, but if you're drawing your thread on an angle, it will shear straight through 32 count linen like a hot knife through butter.
Good to know going in. Good to know. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about beginners.
Yeah.
I've had people say to me, Mary Corbett was the first one that said it to me, is that gold work isn't tough. Isn't difficult. You just have to be patient and take your time. But it looks intimidating for a beginner. Is it something that...
Okay.
Yeah.
I always tell people that if you can thread a needle, tie a knot in the end of the thread, sew a straight stitch and sew on a bead, then you can do gold work, because they're the basics. We're always using a knotted thread. We're always using a Gutermann thread in our needle to apply the metal threads. And the metal threads are either couched on the surface with a straight stitch, or they're hollow and you cut them to length and sew them on like a bead. So the basics of gold work are very easy. Where gold work gets hard is when you're doing formal laying. So if you're laying smooth pearl or bright check pearl or any of those, if you're laying them and you're trying to fill a shape and you're trying to get the right angle and you're trying to work around a corner, then you have to leave little gaps. So it's that cutting the right length that people have issues with.
Okay.
So you know, gold work in its simplest form is very easy. And so when I do beginners projects, they have easy techniques in them. And I like to put a hard technique in for every easy technique when I'm doing, you know, intermediate or above type projects. For everything that is difficult and drives you crazy, like doing laid work or doing essing, which is stem stitch in pearl, then I'll put something easy in, like applying kid leather or, you know, because there are easy techniques as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you can do a complete design just using easy techniques. You don't have to have any hard techniques in there at all. So, you know, you can build up to them.
So it's approachable by anyone who can thread a needle then. Yeah, you said that.
Well,
yeah.
my daughter started doing gold work when she was 7.
Oh, okay.
And she did. Actually, I'll tell you a funny story. We were at a retreat and Beck was 8 by this stage and she decided that she was going to come on the retreat. She was going to help me teach, which is like, oh, that'd be really cool, Beck, you know. Except when we got there, she said, I'm going to stitch the project. I'm not going to do the teaching. And, of course, going to an embroidery retreat when you're 8 years old means that you end up with, you know, 15 nanas in the room. So Everybody just eats her up. Eats her up with a spoon and she sits there and she stitches. And it was really funny. It was a small project. People were being finished by afternoon tea time. That was nice. We go to stop for supper that night and there were 2 people missing from supper, the youngest and the oldest.
Uh-oh.
So Becky and Olwen were sitting there going stitch for stitch because neither of them wanted to be last. So anyway, we forced the 2 of them to come and have something to eat and then they disappeared and they were going stitch for stitch again. Anyway, so the next day, the woman who actually started this group, who has since passed away, but when she started this group and she doesn't come on the retreats anymore, but she would actually come to have a look at what everyone was working on. And so she came along and she was sort of standing beside me. And there was a piece of embroidery and it was sort of between Becky and I. And so she said, oh, how did everyone go with the project? And everyone's like, oh, it's good, but you should see Becky's. And everyone kept saying, oh, yeah, no, it was great, but you should see Becky's. And, of course, she'd gone the long way around because she really was standing beside Becky when she had started. And so she picks it up and she says, so where's yours, Becky? Everyone says, I need to look at yours. And Beck picks up hers and gives it to her and she just goes, I thought that was your mother's. So Beck doesn't stitch anymore, but even at 8, she, you know, perfect eyesight and nimble fingers. Kids are amazing. And when I'm at craft shows, you get every now and then, and I mean, I'm a member of the Embroiderers Guild and I love the Embroiderers Guild. It is the best institution in the world, but you get the odd people who like to think that gold work is elitist and they, oh, no, you can't do that. That's for very experienced stitchers, you know, and I laugh. And I go, hang on a minute. I said, can I borrow your kid for a minute? And I, if there's somebody standing nearby with a kid while I'm demonstrating, I go, okay, can you cut this and can you pick it up on the needle and can you just sew that? Oh, yeah, that was really hard. Thank you. You know, no, keep going. And I'll stand there and talk to people and let a complete stranger's 5-year-old work on my embroidery doing chipping because chipping is not hard. It's an easy technique. It's like I say, there are easy ones and there are hard ones. And you know, it just points out to people that, you know, well, if that kid can do it. And sometimes when Beck was about 10 or 11, she used to come to the craft fair with me and she'd sit there and demonstrate one day and people would all be just gobsmacked that this kid's sitting there doing gold work. And I go, well, it's not hard. You know, elements of it are hard. There are cutting the right length and getting the right angle when you're doing with pearl is hard. Brick stitch, people find challenging to get their rows close together that if you bring your needle up a 2 threads gap away and you take it down on a 45 degree angle against the existing stitching, you will never get gaps. Mm. You know, it's people who tell me, you know, if people ring me up over the phone and they've done a class with somebody and they're getting gaps in their brick stitch, I can tell them they're coming up on the wrong side of their threads. And the same when you're laying purl. If you come up on the wrong side of the area that you're laying, you're going to lose your angle. And so, you know, I can troubleshoot that over the phone without even seeing what they're doing. If they've lost their angle, I know they've brought their needle up on the wrong side. So
yeah.
It's that simple.
Do we to get started with gold work, do we need a lot of tools? Are there specialty tools that you must have?
Not really. A number 10 crawl needle is a must because that goes through probably 95% of the threads and the kid leather. You need a pair of fine, sharp scissors. You can go out and buy Goldwork scissors, which have a serrated blade. But when you're first starting, just an old pair of nail scissors are fine. Just, you know, an old pair of embroidery scissors. Buy yourself a new pair of embroidery scissors and use your old ones. Or go to the craft, if you're at the craft fair and you can see someone that's selling a pair of, you know, $5 little sharp scissors, they'd be fine to start with. The Goldwork scissors do make it easy because the serrated blade holds the purl while you're cutting it. Mm-hmm. But they're not necessary to start with. You do need a cutting pad, but a cutting pad can just be a piece of leftover velvet or corduroy glued onto a piece of cardboard. So that's, again, not a huge expensive thing. I recommend people use a clamp because then that means that you can use both hands. When you're hands-free, you've got one hand holding the needle, the other one manipulating the thread. So having something holding your hoop or your frame, whatever you're working in, is beneficial. So I always say a clamp. And you do need beeswax, which, again, is only a couple of dollars. So we wax our Gutermann thread to prolong its life. When you're stitching with the metal threads, it does wear the Gutermann quite quickly. Mm. So you need to condition it with the wax. A lot of people think that that's supposed to stop it from knotting. That has nothing to do with it. It's to strengthen the thread so that it's not wearing out so quickly.
Okay.
As it passes over the metal. So you don't need a mellor to start. A mellor is something that's, you know, if you decide you want to do more gold work and you want to do it the Royal School of Needlework way, then buy a mellor. But the rounded end of a mellor, your thumbnail does the same thing as. And the sharp, pointy end of a mellor, you can use a chenille needle for. So you don't, you know, I have two mellors and I tend to end up just using the needle that's even in my hand. Sometimes I just use the crawl needle to run it down. So, you know, when you're using a mellor, it's the rounded end is used for shaping and tidying up things and running. If you've got a thumbnail, you can run your thumbnail around it and do the same thing. So at the minute, I don't have any thumbnails. I've broken them. So I'm using my mellor for that. You don't need – it's not a huge expense, but the threads are expensive. So that's where, you know, this – I think too where the elitism – thing comes in with gold work. It isn't a cheap hobby to take up. It's, you know, stump work, gold work, and of course Japanese are probably the three most expensive forms of embroidery to take up, Japanese being the most expensive. Mm-hmm. Followed by gold work and stump work. So you know, some of the threads are expensive. You know, Grecian, the thicker Grecian is $12 a meter. Got a pearl number 3 is $27 a meter. So, you know, the pearl, you're stretching it out. The finer it is, the cheaper it gets. So the fine ones are only $3.50 a meter, and you stretch them out before you use them. So you're really getting about a meter and a half. So compared to stranded cottons and things, they're expensive. But when you look at it as a kit from a kit point of view, you know, I have kits starting at $16 for beginners. So it's not like it's a huge expense.
Yeah.
Not really. Not when you buy a kit, you're getting what you need rather than, you know, I put in what I've used plus some extra so that you can stuff something up and unpick it and not have to worry about the thread. So, you know, it's I think kits are a good way for beginners to go rather than getting an assortment of threads because, for starters, they don't know what the thread looks like, which is, you know, why this book will be helpful. And secondly, they sort of, if you've never used it before, you don't know how much to buy because it's not like other things that come in a skein or a reel.
Right.
You're actually buying, you know, if you need 20 centimetres and you buy 20 centimetres. So you don't have to buy a full packet of many of the threads.
Yeah, and I guess I would guess that for most people, that's one of the bigger challenges because for most people, they just can't go to their local needlework store and get this kind of material.
Yeah, and most local network stores don't stock it either. So,
right, that's
I
what
mean,
I mean,
here
yeah,
in,
yeah.
here in Australia, the local network shops, a couple of them, I know there's a shop in All Threads in Queensland and a Stitch in Time in Hobart. They've got them. They're under the counter. Because when you have them on display, I remember when Lazy Daisy was around, they had them on the end of the hanging, you know, on a display.
Uh-huh.
And people would come up and go, oh, isn't that pretty? And they'd squeeze the bag and give,
oh, no.
you know, and they crushed the thread. And, you know, and she'd have a bag and it had $20 worth of thread in it, and it's not worth 5 cents now because it's all crushed. And, you know, so any shops that do sell it tend to keep it in under, you know, in a glass cabinet. It's under the counter. Bustle and Bowes have some in Melbourne. You know, a lot of shops stock a little bit so that they can keep people going. But yeah, they by no means would they have the full range of threads. And myself, at any one time, I've got about 90% of the different threads in stock.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always happy to order. So if I don't have it, I'll order it in for you. It's that easy. But all of these threads are handmade in England, and they're all made to order.
No.
So they're not stockpiled. So you have to wait for them. So mm-hmm. an order could take 2 months to arrive, and if they're busy, it could take three. So, you know, I'm constantly, the orders I placed a week ago were for what I need for summer school in January. So, you know, I'm working 5 and 6 months in advance, when I'm ordering in threads.
And
so,
and England is pretty much the global source for these kinds of threads.
Well, it is, but they're also made, they're made in France. They're still made in France. I don't actually have a French supplier, but I know you can buy them in France, and I know they're French threads. I know that they're made in Germany because I do have some German threads. And some of the threads that are sold through Laces are German threads and French threads. So, and I have some thread that somebody brought back from Dubai for me. It is used through it is used throughout the world. In you know, gold work is pretty well a very widespread across the world. Thread to use,
mm-hmm.
and so it is made in all these different countries. And so, like in Japan, they don't use the pearl threads; they only use couching threads. But they produce them themselves. And when you look at the names of some of these threads, like you get Jap Gold. Jap Gold is because it was made in Japan, and you still get Japan thread and imitation Jap because when it was Japan Gold, it was actual gold still.
Oh.
It was gold in that case. It was gold painted onto rice paper, and then it was cut into ribbons and wound around a core thread.
Wait a minute, you paint gold onto rice paper, cut it into ribbons,
yep.
and wrap it
and then wrap it. So as opposed to the Aurum Batarum, where they were actually beating it out into leaf and then cutting and then winding that around the core thread, so these days it's basically painted, and you still get them. You can still get the gold thread. It's very expensive.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Not many people stock it. Not many people use it. Really, the only people who still currently use that actively are Japanese embroiderers. But that thread has also been known as Venice gold because it was made in Venice, and it was known as Cyprus gold because it was made in Cyprus. So that, you know, it followed the Silk Route across Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Until it got to England, you know, and England is still making it. but, you know, if you're reading any old, you know, texts on embroidery and they talk about Cyprus gold and Venice gold, it's just a couching thread. You know, it is what we call Jap thread today, or in England what we call imitation Jap thread because it's not being made in Japan.
Mm.
So it's a metal alloy painted onto rice paper, which is cut into ribbons and wrapped around the core thread. So you think about the, you know, they call it spinning. It's spun onto the thread. So which to me conjures up images of Rumpelstiltskin.
Right.
So, which of course it isn't, but you know, so you know, it's cool, you know, that all these things, and they are still handmade. So you have to wait. You can't just ring up and say, send me this express post. They've got to make it first. So,
and see, that gets to that amazing craftsmanship that goes into stuff that you use to do amazing craftsmanship. And
exactly. Yeah. And it's kind of sad to think that there are only, I mean, England has an endangered crafts list, and those two those two businesses making those thread are both on it, because that's it. They are two businesses, you know. So it's, you know, but it's really, it's awesome, you know, and I just love it. And I was visiting Bill Barnes and on the first time I visited Bill, and he was showing me how he makes the various threads and things. And then he actually made some bullion. So bullion is fat pearl. So when you get your pearl threads, the higher the number, the finer the thread. When you get down to number four, it's still pearl. But when it gets thicker than that, they call it bullion. And it's still hand wound onto a mandrel. So you're holding the gold thread in one hand, you hook it in the end of the mandrel, and then you turn the mandrel with your other hand, and you have to make sure that those gold coils lie side by side. Otherwise, you're going to, it's like it's been stretched out already. So, and I mean, you can buy a jig like that for using with bead wire and I think they call them a whirly gig or something like that anyway, but for making coils of bead wire to put into your bead embroidery. But it's exactly the same technique as what they're doing to make bullion. And so Bill made me, you know, he's showing me how he makes the bullion. He made this piece, and, of course, that only ends up about a 10 to 15 centimetre length. They're quite short. And so he puts that in my hand, and I go, oh, I'm going to just keep this. I can't possibly use this because you made it for me. He said, I make all of your thread for you.
Oh.
I said, yes, you do, but you made this one in front of me. So he then made another one. He said, here, we'll use this one then. So it was a huge joke, you know, that, you know, because, but yeah, he made it in front of me. So I wanted to keep it as a memento of the trip and the visit.
Sure.
So, but it was really funny because he says, he just looks at me. He says, I make all of your thread.
There's no other option.
There's no other option. It's him making it, or it's Benton and Johnson making it. So it's very cool. But let's say I had a friend who came back from Dubai, and she found some while she was in Dubai, and she brought me back 100. Oh, it's probably about 200 grams. It's a lovely big hank of it, and it's a beautiful buttery apricot color. It's beautiful. It's a rough pearl, but it has a completely different color. That, you know, even, you know, throughout the Middle East, it's used on their bridal veils and things like that. So, it is across the world. It's in use, but, and as I said, before we came to air, you know, all the way across the world and throughout history, gold work is there. It's got different styles from different countries and different styles in different periods of time. So it's very cool. You know, Australia's probably the only place that it didn't actually, you know, was not something that was used. But right throughout Asia and Europe and into Africa. So there are some fantastic religious I don't even want to say vestments, I want to say garb, you know, gorgeous big golden umbrellas and, you know, really, really cool things, very different to Western church. But, you know, if you look up the embroidery on the clothing of the Ethiopian royal family, for example, you know, going back a couple of hundred years, they've got amazing gold work embroidery, which, you know, would have traveled across from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But it has its own style, so it's very cool.
Do you find that because of its location Australia's location on the globe, and the different cultures that have passed through or ended up there, do you find that you get influences from all cultures in the needlework?
Yeah, and food.
Oh, okay.
More importantly. Yeah, no, we do. And while the style of embroidery that I do is predominantly English, you know, I'm inspired by stuff from everywhere, you know, and I think that's the best part about being in Australia and in New Zealand, is that we're not so busy looking over our shoulder at history and what the people before us have done.
Mm-hmm.
We're busy going forwards and thinking, how can we use this? You know, this is really cool, but how can we use it our way? So I think the fact that Australia and New Zealand are somewhat isolated by distance, you know, we've had so many cultures come and live here that, you know, there's just some amazing stuff. I was demonstrating at a craft fair once, and this lady came up to show me her work, and she said, I was here yesterday and I saw what you were doing. I thought you might like to see what I do. And she brought in some gagnatelle, and gagnatelle is the traditional embroidery of Malta. And it is absolutely stunning. It uses metal thread as well as silk. It's three-dimensional. It's absolutely amazing. And I said, oh, go, I've seen this before, because there's a lady that I know in Bendigo who was researching and playing with it. So, which is about, you know, nearly 2 hours away from where I am. And so we had this lovely discussion. We were talking about it. And it was not long after that I come across a European magazine, and there was a lady who was busy researching the history of Austrian nuns' work and trying to work out how it was done. And it was like she's come to all these really amazing conclusions. What she didn't realise was the nuns took it to Malta, and they still do it today, and the Maltese women have moved all over the world. And so you could actually learn that technique face-to-face in Melbourne, in Sydney, in Auckland, in New Zealand. You can learn it. You could probably learn it anywhere in America. And this lady in Europe is busy trying to decipher old texts and things in convents to work out how they did it. And it's like, you know, they took it to a country, that country adopted it, they're still doing it today. So it was just kind of really funny. And it's a technique that was taken across, it was adopted by the English in the Victorian era, and they were, instead of wrapping with silks, they were wrapping the metal threads with wools. And so, you know, it's travelled to so many places, and it was just so funny to read this magazine article of this lady and how she's researching and trying to work out how these, you know, these 350-year-old pieces were worked. And it's like, you actually don't have to research that.
if you just lift your head, it's everywhere, yeah.
It's actually around, yeah. And it was just really cool to think I was at a craft fair demonstrating, and a lady brought me the most beautiful piece to look at, you know, here in Melbourne. So it's just too funny.
Yeah. All right, Alison, boy, what a treat. Thank you so much.
Very welcome.
How do people get the book?
How do people get the book? Well, it's online on my website at the moment. If you're in England, it will be available through Golden Hind as well. They'll be getting theirs in about 3 weeks' time, I think. I just found out last night, actually, I got an email from Access Commodities to say that they are going to be stocking it. So it was already available through a stitching shop in Colorado and Denver. They've ordered a box full to go over to them. So Access Commodities will now be stocking it. So it should be available through any local needlework store in America. So you've just got to ask for it.
What is the shop in Denver?
A stitching shop, it's called.
A stitching shop. I've heard of
them. A stitching shop in Denver and Colorado. So she's ordered a box full. She has been stocking my books for a couple of years now, which has been really nice that you can say, yes, you can get them from here. So, really thrilled that Access have picked us up last night.
Oh, that opens the doors all over. Yes.
It does. It's going to make it so much easier for people. We did have the pre-order offer is still on the website at the moment. So at the moment there's the pre-order offer is that it's $15 cheaper, which helps with the shipping, because as I said, it's an expensive book. So it will be retailing in, Australian money, $54.95, which is probably only about $40 American, your money, because our dollar is really crap at the moment. I took a dive again yesterday. I saw it. I thought, oh, fabulous. This is great. That makes the book really cheap for American people, which is good. The shipping is $35 to get it over to America. So some people go, oh, the shipping's as much as the book. When the Australian tax comes off the book, it actually drops to $36. Mm-hmm. So the shipping is as much as the book, but the book will be reverting back to full price. I did say it would happen when the books arrive, but because the books have arrived a week early, I think I'll probably keep the pre-order. I'll put it up on the website that it'll stay there till Monday, and then it's going to be the retail price. I'll keep it there just a couple of days longer for your listeners.
Okay. All right. Well, congratulations. I'll tell you, just the little bit that I've seen, it's a pretty exciting book, and It's
Thank you.
one of those that I think
Yeah.
people need to own. Yes.
Yeah, look, I'm really chuffed with it. And like I say, it's a reference book. So if you're into gold work, or if you're wanting to take it up, there's something in there for everybody. So.
All right, Allison, thanks so much. Appreciate the time.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me, Gary.
And thanks to everyone for listening.